You're listening to a sermon by Henry Neufeld, recorded on Sunday, September 15th, 2013, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
A few years ago, some of us heard Barbara Brown Taylor do a lecture at the Vancouver School of Theology, and she was talking about preaching. She was talking, I guess, mostly to students. And included in that talk were comments about preachers who have to preach a lot. And she said, sometimes you will have a thin sermon. A thin sermon was an interesting way of describing it. And you said the advantage of a poor sermon is that it allows people to work out the gospel on their own later. And I think I might provide you with that opportunity today. The Exodus story of the golden calf is an account of unregulated excess. It's about bowing down to worship an idol when people become impatient with God, or when God seems hidden and totally unavailable. Now, the story has some interesting views of God. We have Moses on the mountaintop arguing with God over who is responsible for what the Israelites have done. God and Moses blame each other, and that's quite remarkable. I think it's rather brave and risky of Moses to challenge God, yet that's what he does. God tells Moses, go down at once. Your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt, have acted perversely. And Moses is not prepared to take responsibility for what is going on in the valley. Like a defense lawyer, he replies, Lord, why does your wrath burn against your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt? And the blame game goes on. It's like a political debate. It's your fault. No, it's your fault. No, it's your fault. Meanwhile, down in the valley, the people are impatient. Moses has been gone for 40 days, and the people tell Aaron, make us gods who will go before us, because we don't know what's happened to Moses, and we need a god. Aaron collects their gold jewelry, he melts it, and builds them a golden calf. God gets angry and threatens to destroy his people. And Moses argues with God and begs him, turn your fierce anger away, relent, do not bring disaster on your people. And God relents and agrees not to destroy them. Now this is amazing because Moses got God to change his mind. It's probably a picture of love winning out over anger. Well, why did the Israelites ask Aaron to create a golden calf? They were afraid, and fear is a great motivator. They were terrified that without Moses, they did not know what would happen to them. So when Moses comes down from the mountain with two tablets of God's writing, he finds the people singing, dancing, and having a party. And he gets mad, throws the tablets away, takes the golden calf, burns it. It was probably made of wood overlaid with gold. And he scatters the ashes on the water and then makes the Israelites drink it. He sees the people running wild. He says, whoever is for the Lord, come to me. And all the Levites report to Moses. And Moses tells them, go through the camp, killing your brother, your friend, and your neighbor. That day they killed 3,000 people. Moses asserted his authority. Idolatry. A person or thing that is the object of excessive devotion. giving something our devoted admiration. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven or earth. You shall not bow down to them to worship them. That's the second commandment. An idol is anything that we build our lives around other than God. So what are the golden calves in our culture that draw us away from God? After the stock market crash in 1987, the sculptor Arthur de Modica made a statue of a charging bull, which stands in Bowling Green Park near New York's Wall Street. It weighs over 7,000 pounds. I don't know what that is in metric. It's 11 feet high. It's 16 feet long. The bull is a symbol of aggressive financial optimism. In the stock market, we have bull and bear markets. The bull market, the bull is charging ahead, the market is increasing. Bear market, the bear is hibernating and the market is going down. A rabbi called the bull a golden calf. And he wrote that the Occupy Wall Street movement of 2011 wanted to smash the golden calf, or the bronze bull, and challenge the greed and worship of Wall Street. What are the idols closer to home? Power, status, education, a bunch of cars, a graduate degree, property, a high-paying job, the Bible, an iPad. I read some sermons by rabbis about idols, and one suggested that many Jews have made the state of Israel their idol. Jeremiah told the Israelites, "Put your detestable idols out of my sight." So what causes us to turn away from God and to pursue an idol? The parable of the shrewd manager. This is one of the most difficult to interpret, because it seems on first reading that Jesus is endorsing the unethical behavior of a manager. The rich man has this manager who was accused of mismanagement, so he has an audit. Problems emerge. So he calls the manager in and asks for an accounting. The man offers no explanation for his behavior. He doesn't argue or try to defend himself. And not surprisingly, he's fired. So he's in a jam. He's about to be unemployed. He's not strong enough to do physical labor. He doesn't want to go begging or apply for welfare. So he calls in the people who owe the rich man money and reduces the amount they have to repay him. He's endearing himself to these people. And the rich man commends the manager for his cunning. Now, presumably, the rich man isn't suffering due to the manager's actions. He's not going to hurt him financially. And he's not mad at him. He has a grudging admiration for him. I play email chess with a friend in Manitoba. He makes a move. He sends it to me. And I have 10 days to respond with a move. These games take a while. And now my friend is a better chess player than I am, so sometimes I'm surprised at the moves he makes, moves which I didn't see coming. And even though he's my opponent, I still admire his skill and his cleverness in making the moves that he made. Like the rich man in the parable who respected his manager for his shrewdness, I admire my chess opponent for his moves. I have grudging admiration for him, but admiration nonetheless. I think the rich man, the manager in the story, represents the Pharisees and church leaders. Jesus is condemning the Pharisees for the fact that they have been unfaithful in their dealings with worldly wealth. So So how can they be expected to administer the true riches of spiritual life and kingdom issues? The religious leaders supported their lavish lifestyles with a temple tax that every Jew was required to pay. The average Jewish peasant struggled to survive. The temple taxes, combined with the taxes imposed by Herod and Rome, were literally threatening the existence of the Jewish people. The people were carrying a burden they could scarcely bear or tolerate. And Jesus is using this parable to contrast the unrighteous manager, who acts wisely, with the Pharisees, who do not. Their master, the Lord, has heard that the Pharisees have been squandering his resources, so he calls them to give an account of their stewardship. The manager in the parable acts wisely or shrewdly, and he blesses the tenants in order to find favor with them. And he is commended by his master. Jesus says that this unrighteous manager is wiser than the sons of light. The sons of light is a term used to refer to the tribes of Levi, Judah, and Benjamin, and refers to the priests and rulers. The Pharisees are condemned by Jesus for squandering God's stuff, the things that belong to God and the teachings of God, when they should have been good managers, bringing honor to their master and managing the household well. The manager is not commended for being dishonest. He is commended for blessing the tenants and for wisely reducing the burden on them. The key of the parable is in its comparison. Don't be like the unjust steward. Be a good manager. In comparison to the Pharisees, even an unrighteous manager deserves more commending than they do. The priests and rulers should be using their wealth and influence to be a blessing to others. The wealth of God is to be used to lavishly bless people, not to hoard it and to store it in barns, even if the barn is a temple. The Jewish rulers needed to reduce the burden placed upon the people. And Jesus later on in Matthew says this about them: they tie up heavy loads and put them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. The Pharisees have been unfaithful. They demanded a heavy burden from the people. They imposed endless religious rules. And in that third hymn we sang, there was a beautiful verse about we impose strictness that God will not own. Endless rules. They squandered the tithes and offerings given by the people in worship to God. And they dissipated it, much like the prodigal did his inheritance. So if this is how they behave, how could they possibly effectively communicate the love and grace of the landowner or graciously minister that love to the people? And I sometimes wonder if this is similar to churches today spending millions on physical facilities and property. If they were truly serving God, the Pharisee, as managers, would not have placed such a heavy burden on the people. Their church, their status, and the Jewish law became their golden calf, their idol. Peterson puts it this way: here's a lesson. Use your worldly resources to benefit others and make friends. Then when your earthly possessions are gone, it will welcome you to an eternal home. The unjust manager is not set before us as an example of cheating his master or to justify dishonesty, but to point out the careful ways of worldly men. It would be well if the children of light would learn wisdom from the men of the world. And Jesus punctuated this by saying, if you are untrustworthy about worldly wealth, who will trust you with the true riches of heaven? So, I end with two questions. Can we get God to change his mind, like Moses did? And the wealth we have is the good news of a new kingdom. How are we dealing with that wealth?